You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio, and we are streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And my co-host this evening is Katie O'Brien, and our special guest is Andrew Johnson. He is returning again with us, and I'm going to let Andrew explain what he does and why he has why he is doing what he's doing. And his website, by the way, is checktheevidence.com. Andrew?
Hi, thanks for inviting me back to speak with you. Yeah. Well, really, I think I've been sort of guided into what I'm doing just because, you know, you get to the point of finding a lot of information that doesn't seem to be generally known about, and you feel the need to actually bring this information forward and make more people aware of it. And for myself, it really started, you know, to become more important in 2003. You know, I always had this suspicion since I was quite young that there was other things going on in the world that weren't really being talked about in the appropriate way. But it was in 2003 that I discovered this thing called the Disclosure Project, which actually happened, you know, 2 years previous to when I discovered it. In other words, it happened in 2001 and I discovered it in 2003. And this was the event where there were 21 witnesses who had been in the Army, Navy, Air Force, and they were coming forward and asking for congressional hearings into their experiences, which, you know, were involved with extraterrestrial craft and, you know, various things related to that. And when I listened to this press conference, which was, you know, put together by Dr. Stephen Greer, I couldn't really believe that I hadn't heard about this because it was so significant. And I discovered a small article on the BBC website, which didn't really describe this event appropriately. That really, you know, proved to me that they were covering this up, and that this was a very significant event, the Disclosure Project press conference, and it wasn't being reported properly. So I then continued to research the Disclosure Project, and I actually started taking this video out on a laptop, and I showed it to some small groups of people to get their reaction to it, because this essentially proved the cover-up. And so in researching that, I began to find other things which had been, you know, comprehensively covered up, particularly, you know, in relation to 9/11. And I started to research into that, and I discovered things like how terrorist groups were funded by the CIA, and how Al-Qaeda was essentially created from what used to be the Mujahideen, which was a kind of a list of insurgents that these groups would call on to go and fight the Russians, and that eventually became Al-Qaeda. So I began to find out more about that, which led me into a number of other areas, ultimately into, you know, finding out the things about cancer, the cures that have been covered up over the years. Somebody sent me an e-book about the cancer cover-up and the other health cover-ups.
Is that Dr. Griffin, is that Ed Griffin's book?
The book that I read was the Politics in Healing, which is by, I'm trying to remember his name, but it had a foreword by Senator Berkeley Bedell, who also, I think, came down with cancer, and he took alternative treatments and was cured, or, you know, went into remission, however you care to phrase it. And, you know, and then much later on, I discovered things like in this country, in the UK, we have this thing called the Cancer Act, which was actually passed as long ago as 1939. And it is illegal for anyone outside the medical profession to claim that they have cured cancer. So this really was something in law which essentially was very suspicious to me, that they should not, they should actually forbid anyone from claiming that they've cured cancer and make it illegal
Might I add that I've never heard the medical profession say they ever cure it either.
That's true. They always have to say that they go into remission, you know, and they and this sort of so the language is such that once you get cancer, it's incurable. That's the kind of, you know, the way that it's actually presented to people. It's a death sentence. When of course a number of people, Max Factor's son being one of them, who was somebody in this country who was. Survived for many years. I think he's still alive even today, having been diagnosed with quite a serious form of cancer. So yes, I mean, and that ties into the work of G. Edward Griffin and his work on B17, The World Without Cancer. I discovered that video, I think, a few years ago now, and that was made, I think, in 1977 or around that time. So, you know, you begin to find all these things and you see a pattern emerging from this, which this is what I, you know, put on the website. If you log in and register, you'll find you can access some various audio files which cover most of these subjects. And you know, in the last couple of years, what I've really felt is that there are all these researchers working on these areas. Some are working on cancer. Some are working on, you know, vaccinations. Some are working on the UFO and the ET. Information. Some are working on 9/11. Some are working on chemtrails, and they're not really don't seem to be talking to each other very much. It still kind of baffles me a bit as to why. Because once you get into the situation where you're trying to look at the evidence and you're trying to get to the bottom of things, for myself, I feel I have to look at, you know, review everything, review religion, review the energy situation, review all these things, and look for the alternative evidence which has been covered up. And my background for doing this really is one of software development, which involves having to, you know, you typically with software development, you're given a problem to solve, you have to analyze the problem, then you have to work out how to solve it. Then once you've developed the solution, you have to implement the solution. And then as you're implementing the solution, you find that the implementation is not good enough, there's faults in it, there are flaws in the original design, so you have to go and fix those. You know, you put it onto a computer system, the computer system's got bugs of some kind, or you're putting it onto new hardware and the new hardware doesn't work properly. So you have to be adaptable, you have to continually analyse what's going on. So really it's those sort of skills which I've tried to bring to bear on looking at the evidence that's out there. And it, you know, at times it's a very difficult task because the evidence is so difficult to get hold of sometimes, and then it also becomes muddled up and covered up. And for example, you know, I got involved with Dr. Judy Woods. We essentially discovered that there was the official story of 9/11. Then there's what we've come to call the official truth, and then there is the real evidence, the real story, which you can get to if you keep looking at the evidence and you're continually questioning your own conclusions and trying to continually review them. So, you know, and then over in that whole sort of process, what I'm seeing is the fear agenda being played out. That's the sort of common theme to all of this, that there is this agenda of fear, which is driving pretty much everything in the world today. You know, the credit crunch, the swine flu, the climate. You know, they're all going to kill us or get us one way or another, you know, and then we're getting the alien thing ramped up. We've even got a story in the Daily Telegraph today in the UK about a Bulgarian scientist who says he's communicated with aliens. And the Daily Telegraph, which is a popular broadsheet quality newspaper in the UK, it's only really been publishing these sorts of stories with regularity in about the last 18 months. So something is going on with the alien question, and I'm seeing a lot of a big shift in the mainstream media. I mean, we've had four or five Larry King CNN Live specials in the last sort of couple of years, whereas prior to that, he'd only done, I think, about one in 10 years. So why are we getting all this sudden interest in the mainstream media in the ET question? And a point I've made a couple of times, and I'll make it again here, is I can tell one, I know I'm sort of jumping around on a lot of topics here, but this is what I've done on the website, basically. But one particular thing I'd like to mention in relation to the UFO issue is the story which is told by Professor Robert Jacobs. He was an optical instrumentation officer in the Air Force, yes, the Air Force, and I think it was in 1967, he was set an assignment to film the launch of a missile which would carry a nuclear warhead. It, at the time, it was carrying a dummy warhead, but it was all set up as if it was a, you know, a real warhead. And his team had to film this launch, which was from Big Sur, and they had this special telescope which was I think it was a 180-inch focal length, so it's a very large amount of zoom. And they used a radar tracking mount to actually capture this missile launch. And he tells the story, and, you know, you can watch it. It's on YouTube. It's on the internet. And he tells this story of them filming this launch, and they got this fantastic film. And it was the first time they'd done it. It was a radar tracking mount, and they got a brilliant shot of it. They could see it in the finderscope that they got it. And then they went to develop the film at Vandenberg Air Force Base. And this was the next day, and the film was developed by I think his one of his senior officers, or it was passed to his senior officer, who's called Sonny Mansman, and they developed the film, and Sonny Mansman took Robert Jacobs into the projection room, and he said, "Watch this." And Robert Jacobs then describes how they had a brilliant picture of the missile. It filled the frame from 120 miles away. The missile was 120 miles from the camera, and it filled the frame. And then as they were, you know, the camera was tracking the missile moving, they saw an object come into the frame, and it was a flying saucer. And the object shot a beam of light at the warhead three times, and then the warhead tumbled away from the body of the missile, and the object left. And Sonny Mansman said to Robert Jacobs, "What the hell was that?" And he said, "It looks like we've got a UFO." And Sonny Mansman says, "Were you guys screwing around up there?" And of course he says, "No, of course we weren't. How could we have screwed around like that?" And he said that there were two guys in the room, and they took the film, and they said, "Right, you know, you're not to tell anyone about this, and we're going to take this film, and you're now off the hook with this, but you're not going to disclose this to anyone." And then they left, and these guys were in civilian clothes. And so that story was told by Robert Jacobs publicly on his radio program in 1982. So that's 27 years ago, over 27 years ago, and yet that story was only told on CNN in I think 2007. So it had taken them, or was it 2008 even? So it had taken them 26 years to put that story on mainstream media, and this was backed by evidence because Robert Jacobs had a letter from Sonny Mansman, a handwritten letter, describing this event and verifying that this all happened, and they saw the film and they saw the object on it, double lenticular shaped, I think it was described as. And Sonny Mansman actually says in this interview, you know, this was thought to be extraterrestrial at the time, but, you know, we couldn't really say any more than that. So he confirms this whole incident, so it's all documented. Of course, we haven't got the film because Robert Jacobs said he did research and nobody at Vandenberg ever saw it after he'd seen it in that projection theatre, according to his research. So all this was covered up. And, of course, this has huge implications for the whole of the nuclear arms sort of scenario. I mean, if we have some force, something which can come into the atmosphere and disable or knock out these weapons and then leave as if nothing had happened, I mean, this is extraordinary. You know, I mean, it completely, you know, negates any idea that nuclear weapons are any kind of ultimate weapon. So, you know, again...
Wait a minute now. Isn't this also about the time that they were talking or working with the Star Wars program?
Well, that was much later. I mean, that was in the Reagan administration in the 1980s. So,
okay. So I guess I have the time frame confused here.
Sure. Well, sorry. Yeah. Let me sort of clarify that again, because the story that I told you, or Robert Jacobs' story, which I told you, that took place in 1967. He kept it secret. He kept it to himself until he had a talk show, you know, perhaps much like your own program that he used to do. He called himself BJ the DJ. I remember that. I've got a broadcast of him telling this story. And he just decided to tell it one night on the radio in 1982. And he got threatened after that. He had his, he received death threats over the phone. He had his mailbox blown up, you know, outside his house. And things like this, or set on fire or something. But he continued to tell this story, and he told it to the Disclosure Project in year 2000, and it was featured in a documentary called Out of the Blue in 2003. But my point was that even though this story was well documented, it had come from an officer in the Air Force, a ranking optical instrumentation officer who had all the evidence to prove who he was and what he used to do, and it was never covered by the mainstream media. So we see we both have an agenda to cover up the information, and we have an agenda to release the information at a certain time, or not so much release it, but allow it to be disseminated to a wider audience, if you see the point I'm making.
Uh-huh.
So what are we building up to? We're building up to something. I don't know exactly what it is. What I can say is that we've got other people like Michael Sala, who runs this Exopolitics Institute. He's recently written an article which says that Obama is going to make a disclosure announcement on the 27th of December or the 27th, it can't be the 27th of November. So he's predicting that Obama or some member of his administration is going to come out in December. It might even be December the 10th. I haven't got the date in front of me. And he's going to say, yes, you know, everyone, aliens are real. We get over it. I don't think this is going to happen, and I really can't understand why Michael Sala is putting this sort of information out and trying to predict the future in this way, because if it happens, it happens, but I very much doubt that it will happen, and I think if
okay,
it...
You are familiar with the book, the report from Iron Mountain, correct?
Yes. Okay. I'm not the actual book itself, but I'm familiar with the concept behind Iron Mountain, and that they want, they conclude, I think, in this report that the only way to keep the world's population stable, or, you know, not rioting, is to have constant war. Because if there was peace, then, you know, no one would know what to do with themselves or something. I can't remember the exact conclusions, but it's something along those lines.
Well, and I have that book, and it actually came from Laurie Air Force Library, and even though the foreword on it is written to state that it's a hoax, but when you read the whole book, which it isn't a really, it's a pretty small book, actually.
Right.
And when you read the whole book, you find it. Just about everything in it has pretty much come true, except for the part about the disclosure or the use of an aliens from space to come and invade the Earth type scenario.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's several people who've talked about this as well outside of the Iron Mountain thing. I mean, one of the I've made a little video clip that I use in some of my presentations when I do them from time to time. And it's the video clip I've got is from Dr. Carol Rosin, who she claims that she worked with Wernher von Braun for a time, and she was told by him that there were going to be this series of threats presented to the human race, you know, and the one that was current at that time was the Cold War, and the Soviets were going to blow everyone up, and that was the threat that they had to fight in the sort of 60s, 70s and 80s. Then that's, of course, fizzled out at the end of the 1980s, and so they had to have a new threat. And the next threat was going to be asteroids. You know, we've had films like Deep Impact and Armageddon, and I think there's been one or two others. There was a film called Meteor in the 1970s with a, you know, huge asteroid destroying the Earth. And then the next threat after the asteroids was going to be the alien threat. And so Carol Rosin said that this is what Wernher von Braun told her, and it was all going to be based on a lie. Now, Carol Rosin is something of an unusual person from what I've read of some of the correspondence that's been posted on the internet. But nevertheless, I think what she said as regards this manufactured threat, I think is probably correct. And the other little thing that I've worked into this video clip deliberately is I've got a clip of Independence Day, which was made in 1996, and then I've just got the clip where they destroy the Empire State Building in that film with a huge saucer over it, you know, which is about half a mile wide or something ridiculous. And I cut that together with the destruction of the World Trade Center. And when you put those two clips together, and again, I've put this onto YouTube, and you'd find it on YouTube. I've called it The Last Card on YouTube. So if you go onto YouTube and put The Last Card, Carol Rosin, you'll find this clip that I made. And it's really quite eerie to see the destruction of the Empire State Building next to the destruction of the World Trade Center. And it's of course the same city, both in New York. And people then go on to talk about things like Project Bluebeam, which I think is using a combination of technologies that these people who are running the world have to produce all these things, to produce the earthquakes, to produce the fake alien invasion. But all the while, they're calling the shots. They're running it. So the alien invasion isn't real evil aliens. It's the aliens that are already here, that are already have already invaded and already taken over. And I use the term sort of aliens rather loosely here, because the way I like to describe it is, if you look at the you know, the way the world works. And I was talking to a man yesterday who lives quite near to me, and it was a bit of cloak and dagger how I ended up getting in touch with him. And he's been investigating the banking system, and he said that he'd found all the banking corruption. And you know, the people that are running the world, they don't think like you and me. You know, they don't want to sit down on a Sunday night and just talk about things and work out what's going on in the world. They want to kill people, they want to make money, they want to harm people. And this is completely alien to my way of thinking. You know, my work, what I do to earn my living, is I assess disabled students. You know, I help people learn about computers. That's my the tuition that I do for the Open University. I don't want to make a lot of money. I want enough money to live on, but I certainly wouldn't do it, you know, knowingly harming somebody else. You know, so the way that these people think and operate is just totally alien to me. So that's what I mean by aliens running the world.
And maybe those are the true aliens, those bankers that are full of corruption.
Maybe they are. You know, I mean, when you see the pattern, when you see the cancer cures covered up, when you see the free energy technology, which has been developed hundreds of different ways all over the world, you know, by Tesla, by Stan Mayer, the cold fusion guys, Pons and Fleischmann, you know, James Griggs with his hydrosonic pump, Howard Johnson's magnetic motor, Bedini's motor, on and on and on and on and on. You know, you can find 100 examples. All of them have been covered up, suppressed, the inventors threatened, killed, all of this. So who's doing this? Who is controlling this network? You know, and what could we achieve as a people if this we weren't subjected to this sort of control?
You know, I kind of makes me wonder if the patent process isn't working in reverse. Yeah. In other words, it's putting the information into their hands so that they can check it out and do what they want with it before it ever has the opportunity to even meet the world.
I think, you know, this is it. I mean, you know, if you have something like a patent office, then, you know, if people are herded into doing that, then they obviously get a heads up for anybody that, you know, wants to patent something which is a free energy device, they can then shut it down. Or, in fact, I know that Dr. Paul Violetta's talked about this. If they see a free energy device is sufficiently promising, they will declare it. That the patent has to be locked away as a matter of national security, and there are documented examples of that happening. So, what is national security? It's certainly got nothing to do with yours and my security.
It's their security.
It's their security. Yeah, yeah. It's global security. It's the security of the status quo. So all of these things that I've got on the website and that many other people have researched and experienced, all follow the same pattern. And I think what seems to be hard for people is to see this pattern recurring everywhere. You know, I mean, I was talking to this gentleman yesterday, and he discovered this awful, what he was telling me was awful about the banking fraud that he investigated. He's lost virtually everything. He's lost his life savings, you know, tens of thousands of pounds he was defrauded out of. He's spent thousands on court cases to try and bring these fraudsters to justice, but they're so integrated with the governmental system and the legal system that he's realised that the whole system is just totally corrupt in terms of the real criminals control the court system and the banking system and the things like the FDA. They're all controlled.
And if you think like these people think, and you really are the kind of control freaks that they are, they want to be in every aspect of control. So, yeah. And it doesn't take that many, but you know, they're there. And for us to be accused of being conspiracy people, look at the evidence.
Exactly. And this is I went and gave a talk down south a couple of weeks ago, and this guy says to me, I hate being called a conspiracy theorist, or he said something like that. I said, well, you know, reject the label. You know, call yourself an evidence analyst. That's what I call myself, you know. I analyze the evidence, you know, because we've got the documents, we've got the court records, you know, to prove enough of what we're saying. And, you know, I'm really getting rather tired now that we've got the BBC, for example, and I had to turn the radio off today because the BBC was on about something to do with climate change, and they have not reported on the main news. They've had a link on the website that somebody from a university in East Anglia, which is called the CRU, the Climate Research Unit, has leaked a 61 megabyte file containing over 1,000 emails from the last 10 years, which illustrate the agenda to promote man-made global warming. And these emails actually sort of say, you know, well, how are we going to cover up the fact that we've got this cooling, you know, in the data? We need to manipulate this to show warming because it's showing the opposite of what we want, you know. And we've got emails saying this, and an email saying, well, you know, the next time that I see this Pat Michaels guy, who's one of the people who says that the man-made global warming is just a fantasy, which it is, of course, he said, the next time I see him, I'm going to kill him. You know, I don't think it's meant literally, but it's meant as a smear. And the BBC won't report this. And even a former BBC reporter who has been on the BBC for years is called Peter Sissons. He retired, I think, last year or earlier this year. He's been very critical of the BBC not allowing enough time to those who reject the anthropomorphic global warming theory, which is what it is. So we have ongoing censorship, we have an agenda which is set, and the media then follow the agenda. Everyone else tends to fall into line. Specifically on the weather issue, I followed global warming for since about 1989 fairly closely, and I knew that it was basically a scam. I never realised they were going to turn it into another tax until obviously more recently. But then when I started to look at the chemtrailing issue and I investigated that for myself, and I did time-lapse photography so I could measure how long the chemtrails last and put an actual figure on it, I photographed grids of trails outside my house, I wrote to the Civil Aviation Authority and I gave them the time and date and said what aircraft made these trails. They can't tell me. I wrote to the local airport with the same information, what caused these trails. They can't tell me. So these grids that I get over my house, nobody can tell me which flights made these grids. And they can't be military flights because I don't live near a military base of any kind. We have a civilian airport about 5 miles away, line of sight from me. So what's making these grids over my house? Nobody can tell me. So what we're looking at there is somebody putting things into our atmosphere, which then leads one towards the conclusion of weather control, weather modification. So this control grid, you know, which I've already discussed, mentions, covers health. It covers things like the cancer cures and the other alternative treatments like ozone therapy. Which is a marvellous treatment for many, many illnesses. It's dirt cheap to make ozone, yet you can't get access to it. You know, you're given all these other expensive treatments. So we've got that.
What is the longest you've ever seen a chemtrail last?
Going back to the chemtrails, yeah. I've got a little video clip which I've measured it as 18 minutes, but that was only because it passed right across the frame of the camera that I had. That's the longest one that I've measured.
Because I was going to say, I've gone on walks that have been extended, hour and a half walks, and seen that same trail there for the whole period of time.
And yesterday, we were chemtrailed all day, and I mean, they're still around today.
Yeah. And that's right. And I mean, I see this just the same. It's just the same here. We had one day, 18th of October 2007, and I had several people from around England because we had a very heavy spraying day. I got some pictures from down south. I got some pictures from further north. I took some because I was going on a drive that day to see a student and took a few in the sort of 100-mile trip that I did. And, right across the country, and then we got satellite photos of it as well, and you could see the trails on the satellite photos. So what we're looking at is something which is global. You have people like Tom Bearden who come out with this ridiculous idea that it's the Russians who are doing all the weather control. So who's doing the chemtrails, Tom? You know, is it the Russians chemtrailing the whole world? You know, you know, they're all over.
Ah, that's a good one because I haven't seen that one drawn together. Yeah.
This is it. And you know, somebody sent me his book. I mean, I'm a bit annoyed with Tom Bearden because somebody sent me his book, and I just his 2005 book called Oblivion. And in this, he's writing about the Russians doing all this scalar interferometry and weather control. And he goes from 1990 to 2004 and talks about the manipulated hurricanes in 2004. I know I'm jumping around a lot here, but this is just sort of off the top of my head and from
my heart. You know, I don't know that that's so totally out to lunch, though, because I've seen, and I can't remember where I found this at, but I saw something to the effect that the law, the way it's written up, that they could have someone else doing the work, even though we were involved with it, that way they avoided the liability or other issues that might have been tied to it.
So you're saying then that if they wanted to do weather manipulation, they'd form a secret agreement with the Russians so that the U.S. people couldn't be blamed for it. That's
kind of what it looks like from the way the law was written.
Yeah, I think I've read something along those lines too, but I'm afraid that doesn't wash with me because then means that may be true and that may be indeed what's happening, but nevertheless, it must mean there is a global interest to that action because...
Well, you couldn't control weather without affecting people all around the world, so there has to be some sort of complicity there at least.
Correct. But then, you know, Bearden skips from 1990 to 2004, and he doesn't even mention Hurricane Erin. Now, if this guy is looking at weather control, he should be looking at all the hurricanes, you know, most of them. So why hasn't he found Hurricane Erin parked right outside New York on 9/11? And why is he in this book talking about Osama bin Laden, you know, who denied it had anything to do with 9/11 on the day that, or the day after it happened? It was only afterwards that they slowly apportioned more blame onto him, and we've even had him mentioned again today by Gordon Brown, saying that Pakistan should give him up. He was Gordon Brown was on the news. That's the British Prime Minister who brought Gordon Brown was on the news, I think, today or yesterday, saying that Osama bin Laden should be handed over by Pakistan or from Pakistan or something. I just didn't even listen to it. I just had no interest in listening to this corrupt individual. But
at the same time, I have also heard perfectly legitimate information come out of people, and yet at this in, like you're saying, with Bearden, then they come out with something that makes you have to question it because you know what there's the other information is, you know, is really questionable.
That's right. And this is how it seems to be working. I mean, for, you know, another example is Dr. Stephen Greer, who had a, you know, I still have some respect for him, but again, he parrots the official 9/11 line. He hasn't said it openly, but he has implied in articles that he's written that Al-Qaeda did 9/11. There's one that he's written called Transformation of Risk, which talks about the global energy crisis. And what I'm seeing is you're getting a lot of these researchers who are, like you say, are putting out some very interesting stuff. And I've got a little video clip from one of Bearden's videos from 1985. And it's a 7-minute long clip, I think. I've got it on my YouTube channel. And he describes this, what he calls scalar interferometry, which he says is what the Russians are using to manipulate the weather. And what he describes sounds very much like the system, which was used to destroy the World Trade Center from, you know, what Dr. Wood has uncovered from the evidence that she's uncovered. It sounds quite similar. So you do begin to wonder why Tom Bearden hasn't sort of said, oh, you know, Dr. Wood, I've just discovered your website, you know, what, give me the most important pictures or something, or, you know, I've never heard him talk about it. And I know he's been quite ill, I think, recently, but never heard him talk about it. And I know he's been told about it. So.
Well, have you heard many other scientists other than
very
those
few.
That are, yeah, because... You get somebody like Hutchison who can speak about it, but
yes.
Then Hutchison seems to be kind of an untouchable in a way.
that's right. Well, you see, I think with John, you know, I've spoken to John a few times, and I set up a new website for him, actually. I can mention that little story. Because if you go onto hutchisoneffect.ca, which is John's previous website, you now find that on the contact page, somebody mentioned is Ace Baker. And apparently John's old webmaster made a deal with Ace Baker following the episode that we had when we linked the Hutchison Effect to 9/11. And Ace Baker has essentially took over that website, or he's listed there as a contact anyway. So this was quite peculiar, and the donations from the website were not going to John either. He discovered that the donation button wasn't. He wasn't getting any money from that. I don't think that would amount to a lot. So I said to John, well, look, you know, I'll set you up another website, which I did, and that's thehutchisoneffect.com. So initially I didn't have time to do it, but now I've sort of put it into quite a reasonable state now, and there's quite a lot of information and documents on there. Now, of course, John Hutchison, he isn't a trained academic scientist who's been through a university. And I think if he had, he wouldn't have uncovered what he has.
Right.
And he wouldn't have had the motivation that he has. I mean, John, in a sense, is quite childlike. And I don't mean that in any way in a derogatory sense. I actually mean it in a very complimentary sense. Because he's got that childlike curiosity. And he wants to do things for the sake of doing them. You know, literally for having fun. If you listen to him. Have you had it? You've had him on the program, haven't you?
Yes.
Yes.
He's great. I want to have
him
back.
Yeah, absolutely. And he just wants to have fun. He doesn't want to harm anyone. He doesn't want to gain anything from his technology. He really wants to educate people that this, you know, what this technology can do. And I think what he's found himself in the midst of is his technology has been kind of Well, I think it's been stolen by the military, really. I don't think John would necessarily say that that has happened, but I think probably deep down he would think it probably that's what has happened. So he's, you know, he's very much driven by trying to educate people, trying to look at the light side of the technology and what it can do, how it can give us free energy. You know, he's made these everlasting batteries, which I think he calls Casimir cells or something. But he says, you know, you can make these, you make 10 of them and only one of them will work or something, and then it doesn't produce a lot of current. So it needs to be developed, you know, into a more specific and reliable process. So he's very much into this idea of, you know, having free energy for everyone, and everyone sort of not having to worry about burning fossil fuels and that type of thing. But he was visited in 1983, I think I may have mentioned this before, but it's probably worth mentioning again, by Colonel John Alexander. And John Alexander spent 4 months in Canada with John Hutchison and a couple of other guys, Alex Pizarro, and I think there was another guy there too as well. It would appear from what John described to us that John Alexander already knew what John Hutchison was doing in terms of the effects that he was seeing. It was like he already knew, you know, where these effects were going to be seen in the room when John set up his equipment. So Los Alamos National Laboratories is where John Alexander was associated with at that time, and I have a friend in Scotland, or rather somebody who sent me some documents. I've not actually met him, but I've emailed him a few times, and he sent me some documents because he did a Freedom of Information request to Los Alamos National Laboratories, and they initially denied that they'd sent anyone to see John Hutchison, but then after a second or third request, they said, oh yes, we found the documents. I think he requested these documents in the late 90s or something. And they did disclose that John Alexander visited, and John Alexander himself makes no secret of this. So John's technology has been known to the military industrial complex since at least 1983. I suspect they knew of it before then. And we can see quite clearly from the effects that John has seen in his experiments. He's had things like jellification of metals, where these metals have gone molten with no heat. Some metal samples have turned to dust, at least at the ends. He's had samples of metal which magnetized in the middle, but not on, you know, outside the middle of it. He's seen these weird fires, spontaneous fires with no fuel. He's seen these time shifting effects in the crystal structure, as he's described it. He's seen effects happening after the equipment's been switched off. He's seen levitation of samples. He has 500 pounds of metal samples which have been affected by these beams of energy that he subjects them to. So this is not somebody who's a fraud, because he's got these 500 pounds of metal samples which show the effects of heat, but with the effects of no heat at the same time, simultaneously, in the same sample. You know, and he sent samples to Denis Kucinich. He sent samples to somebody in Liechtenstein, a member of the royalty there. He sent samples to, I think Steven Seagal, the actor who was in the martial arts films. He's got involved with John. So John knows people. You know, we've posted a 1 hour presentation by him, which was filmed in Seattle in 2008, and he took took a box of these metal samples with him. People are handling these, so we can see that what he's done is real. It's not a conjuring trick. And then we can see these same effects in the evidence that Dr. Wood uncovered at the World Trade Center. We have beams that are kept for NIST, which are bent into a horseshoe shape. If you go to drjudywood.com, you know, you can see this laid out. If you just Google Hutchison effect and 9/11, you'll come up with that. And going back to what you were saying before regarding scientists talking about this stuff, well, John is really one of the only people who wants to talk to us about, you know, or not so much wants to talk to us, but is willing to talk to us about 9/11. You know, and he points out about this story of thermite. He says, you know, thermite is a welding material. How are you going to load up the World Trade Center with welding material, you know, and make it turn to dust? You know, he just describes it as totally crazy, which of course it is. So John, you know, has been quite supportive, really, of the investigation into what happened at the World Trade Center. And of course, you know, as I was saying a few minutes ago, it's to do with free energy. So if you're wondering why you haven't heard about the Hutchison effect and the World Trade Center, it's because free energy was involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center. In other words, they didn't have to come up with some sophisticated power system or beam, you know, massive sort of laser beam or microwave beam that was hot, a conventional microwave beam, to destroy the World Trade Center and put, you know, a billion watts into it. No, not at all. We don't know how much energy was the input energy, because I've described this on other radio programs that if you actually look at the destruction of the World Trade Center, and you look at how the material came apart, it's almost as if the material just sort of, you know, fell apart by itself. And I began to wonder if you look at this at the molecular or atomic level, if somebody had worked out how to manipulate the molecular structure of the material with some type of resonance effect at a molecular level, so that you put a small amount of energy in, and the intrinsic energy within that material is then released in a kind of domino toppling effect, and the material just destroys itself. And that sort of process, because it's happening at an atomic level or a nuclear level even, seems to be ongoing. And we've still got no significant building at Ground Zero 8 years after the attacks. Obviously, they've rebuilt where World Trade Center 7 was, but the other buildings have not been rebuilt at all. And indeed, quite the reverse, because the Bankers Trust across the road from the World Trade Center has been dismantled. So we've actually got deconstruction at the World Trade Center site.
So do you think that maybe that whatever the what would to dematerialize something may be an ongoing effect, or possibly there may be a time factor because of the energies, the multiple energies that are, from what I understand, are involved in having this kind of weaponry or energy use? Are you following what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really tough question to answer, because from what looking at the site, when I was there, I visited Ground Zero on 17th of January 2008, and we noticed they were still seemed to be bringing in or bringing out piles of dirt, and this was most peculiar as to why they would be trying to you know, change the diapers, as I think Dr. Woods used this expression, at Ground Zero, 8 years after the, 7 years after the event. So it does look like there is an ongoing process. I have suggested that it could be some type of low-level nuclear reaction. There is some type of nuclear reaction going on, not in the same way as, you know, with after an atomic bomb has gone off, but it seems to be just a low-level degradation of material, which is happening at a slowish rate. How long it will go on for, I don't know. I mean, John suggested when we did a broadcast with him, just after that visit to New York, it was, I think, on the 18th of January 2008, he suggested that they'd opened up a portal there because of the use of the technology. Now, what he meant by a portal, I don't really understand, but I think what he meant is that there was going to be an ongoing energy effect because of the amount of, you know, destruction that went on there, and the way that the effects that he's seen, because he's seen his metal samples have continued to change, I think, for days and months and even years. If he takes them to a laboratory and they look at the crystalline structure, apparently says they've done this at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. They can see this crystalline structure is changing over time, which doesn't make any sense. So that's about, we don't really have much more information to go on than that, because, you know, you'd really need to go to ground zero, sample the material, take it to a laboratory, put it into some type of equipment which would measure, I don't know, the background radiation or something. But I don't know how to do those measurements, and I don't have the capability of doing it. And again, you're down to the situation with, like you are with the chemtrails. If you say to people, well, I've got this chemtrail cloud over my house, they'll say to you, well, how are you going to prove it's different from an ordinary cloud? And you'll say, well, I need to get a sample. So how are you going to get a sample? Well, how are you going to get, 20,000 feet up in the air to get a sample? And then once you get it, where are you going to send it? You know, and how are you going to be sure that whoever you send it to is going to do an honest analysis and not just throw your sample away and substitute with something else? So, you're then into all those types of problems which other people have come up against for different reasons and in different scenarios. So, all we can do is observe what's still going on, or rather not going on, at ground zero, and try to tie that up with the effects that have already been seen.
What's to say that they didn't try to do a number of different experiments or use of weaponry at the Trade Center, so that it's kind of like the when they had the JFK scenario where you had numerous different assassins show up, and it could have been any one of them?
Well, there is, of course, some of that potential there, but I think looking at what the main factors are, it's clear what the main factors are. The main factors in the destruction of the World Trade Center are the steel turning to dust. That's the key piece of evidence, because if you look at that and think about it, from my knowledge of metallurgy and physics and chemistry, I have a bit of a knowledge of physics and a bit of a knowledge of chemistry. There is no way that I know that you can get 500 miles length of steel girders to turn to dust in 10 seconds, or 20 seconds. There is no technology that's capable of doing that. You can't do it with a nuclear bomb, because that's heat. That would melt the steel. It wouldn't burn it. You can't do it with explosives, because that's heat. And, again, it would melt it. It doesn't burn it. It doesn't turn it to dust, rather. So you're looking at a new type of technology. And that technology that matches with what the Hutchinson effect can do. So,
well, but what it seems to me from looking at some of that evidence, it had a lot of those features, but it might burn something next to something, it didn't touch at all.
Yes. Yes.
So I mean, so it could be real. I can't think of the term I want right now, but you'd find all these different effects taking place around each other when it should have been that effect bleeding in and into a whole area. It was just hit and miss. Kind of like a tornado, where it can hit, knock down one house and then miss the one right next to it.
Yeah, I mean, there is that, but again, if you look at all the evidence, you're seeing these, you're talking about with a tornado, you're talking about something that you can see, and then you can see where it's actually gone. And the reason why, that it's a very sort of tightly focused wind. But even with tornadoes, you can get these field effects, so it would seem, which have very strange effects on materials. But when you have a car, where 2 inches away from an inflated tire, you've got a region of metal which is all wilted and actually, has a sort of looks like burnt paint, but the metal itself is wilted. So what can cause that? How can you get so intense heat with no conduction when you've got metal? Metal conducts heat, and a rubber tire, 12 inches away, it doesn't make any sense. So you're looking at a new type of technology, or maybe a very old type of technology, I don't know, but one which we haven't seen used in a public place in this sort of way.
Does John talk about the technology that's involved with his Hutchinson effect?
Well, he will tell you how he does it. He doesn't give an absolute, 1, 2, 3, this is how you do it, switch this switch, switch that switch, and then it'll work. He hasn't got a schematic set of plans for what he does. He will tell you if you ask him what sort of equipment he uses, which to my understanding a lot of signal generators and things like microwave generators, and he uses some X-radar equipment and this sort of thing. But he says he needs 2 tons of equipment to generate this levitation effect. So you're looking at quite a bit of equipment, and he also has to tune it specifically in a specific way. I know it used to be the case that he used to have to switch on for about half an hour, then it would start to see the effects after about an hour or half an hour. So
it sounded like, and I can't remember if I was listening to you today or somebody else that was talking about, there's 3 or 4 different effects taking place, anywhere from magnetic, electric, and some other form of energy involved. So it's almost kind of like either one could be the factor that's affecting the element that it touches, or all of them, you know.
Well, we've tried to liken this to, for example, it's where you mix in two ingredients together and nothing happens, and then you add a third and the effect happens. I suppose it's a bit like when you're cooking, you might mix 2 ingredients together and, you know, you don't really get much of a taste, but then you add this third thing, which ordinarily might not much have much taste, but when you add it to these other two, it produces this, you know, sort of very strong taste. And I think we're seeing some type of interference effect like this, where he'll be mixing energies of certain frequency, maybe 2 microwave beams of a different frequency, maybe 3 or 4, and then he'll introduce an electrostatic field from a Tesla coil. This has done this in the past. So that introduces an electrostatic field, and then he begins to see the effects. So we're getting some kind of, you know, catalyst type effect as well coming out. And it's almost like you're tweaking the zero point field, which is the underlying energy system, which seems to be behind everything. It's behind the structure of matter, empty space, you know, maybe even human consciousness. It's all an expression of this zero point field or the ether. I think that what Wilhelm Reich discovered with his orgone energy, that could be another sort of form of this zero point field. When you manipulate that with a particular set of resonance effects, then you get all these other effects coming out, which includes free energy and it includes an anti-gravity effect, an anti-gravitational effect. And I'm convinced that the people that are running the world, the evil people that are running the world, wherever they are and whoever they are, they know all about this. They know how this technology works. In fact, we know they know how it works because, as I've said before, and I'll say it again now, they used the technology on 9/11, and they used it successfully because the World Trade Center is no longer there. So we know that they know how this stuff works, and they know how to cover it up, because almost no one realizes what actually happened.
Isn't that amazing to have, you know, I mean, there's just so few people that are really trying to draw it all together. Before I go any further, let me go ahead and state that you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community supported radio, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and the program's archived at www.givemesometruth.info, and your website is checktheevidence.com. www.checktheevidence.com, and we're speaking with Andrew Johnson, and my guest and my co-host is Katie O'Brien.
Yeah, and a disclaimer.
Oh, I'm going to let the person that's going to be doing this program do that one.
Okay. You had it on my checklist.
Okay, well, good. You're doing your job. I just walked off without it, and I don't have it memorized, and I should. Okay, Andrew, go ahead.
Yeah, so, and really what we've seen now, Dr. Wood is unique among the 9/11 researchers, because we know what happened. For those who want to say it's still a mystery, well, you know, they can say that if they like. We know how it was done. We know how the World Trade Center was destroyed. There is no question in my mind that the technology that was used is something which is called, in what we know, the Hutchison effect. You know, I've
say
surmised.
Sorry. Say that again, please. Would you say that again? What effect?
The Hutchison effect. It's the Hutchison effect technology, which was used to destroy the World Trade Center. I have absolutely no doubt about that. I've put my money on this, literally, because you know, the court case that Dr. Wood has filed. You know, I have tried to offer some support with that, and that's how convinced we are that, and she is, and I am, that the evidence is solid. What I'm not convinced about is how a court will judge this evidence and how it will be processed in a court system, because the people that did 9/11, of course, they control the court system. So it's very easy for them to manipulate the system to throw out this case or cover up the evidence or kill off the people who are involved in, you know, presenting the evidence or stopping the courier van that delivers the document to the court. Whatever it takes, it's actually very easy to scupper something like this. But none of that will take away from the analysis of the evidence that shows, you know, the correspondence between these effects, the weird fires that John sees and the weird fires that we've got in photographs and video from the World Trade Center, the effects on the Earth's magnetic field. Dr. Wood uncovered this data from the magnetometers in Alaska, and at 8:46 in the morning, there is a precise dip in the Earth's magnetic field measured on, I think, 5 or 6 different instruments. And 8:46 is, of course, the exact time when the supposed plane struck the North Tower. So how can you get a plane crash affecting the Earth's magnetic field 3,500 miles away?
Well, look, you know, when you talk about where there's just one or two even trying to get the information out, look what they've done with all the scientists trying to debunk the global warming issue. Mm.
That's right. That's a very good point, because we've had tens of thousands of scientists trying to sort of say no, you know, to Al Gore, no, you know, get out of town, you know, you're completely wrong. And even other stuff that I've looked at, for example, the Maunder minimum, which is the count of sunspots, which was done in the 1600s, which ties in with what's called the Little Ice Age. So we know that sunspot activity has an effect on climate, and they even seem to know the cause of this now. It's to do with cosmic reactivity. So, you know, all these things are covered up, and when they go about against the global agenda, which is one of promulgating methods of fear and control. So going back to the court case, Dr. Wood has now filed her case in the Supreme Court. This was done, I think it was about the 14th of October. So, you know, you can look at the filing documents on her website. So this is going forward, and you know, what we're trying to do is try and at least try and get some accountability here, you know, and help force people to look at this evidence and see.
With her filing that case, is that causing her to become more quiet about it again?
Yes, she's reluctant to talk about it other than what's already on the website, because in this sort of case, you know, you're unsure of, if you start discussing particular details, then, you know, the defendants can say, oh, well, you know, you shouldn't have said that, and that's going to wreck the whole thing. So, you know, you've got to be quite careful in how you discuss this. But, you know, what I know she is happy with is what's posted on the website, because, you know, she's posted that herself. Nobody's done it for her. So you can go and look at the documents to see what's there.
What's your premise for getting it into the Supreme Court?
Well, what happened with the last appeal? The last appeal was rejected by the Second Circuit. So the only recourse you have if you want to continue the case is to take it to the Supreme Court, because you start off in the lower courts, then you go to the appeal court, and then you go to the Supreme Court. I mean, I'm not an expert on the, you know, American justice system, because I'm not, you know, I live in the UK, and you know, I don't even know much about the legal system here, really. But I'm pretty sure that's what the system is. You know, that if you want to, you can either just sort of give up and say, oh well, you know, we lost the case, let's not do anything else, or you can take it to the higher court, and you know, in the Supreme Court, it will either, they will make a ruling on the case at some point. Maybe it'll be another year from now. I don't know how long it will take. They will make some ruling on the case, and then I think after that, it will go back down to the lower case courts again. So the basic thing there, of course, is they can bounce, even if they want to be seen to be doing the right thing, they can still bounce this thing around the courts probably for the next 10 years. You know, I mean, I was listening today to a radio program that somebody sent me, and it was I'm trying to remember the guy's name, but it was a guy who took some film of the Robert Kennedy assassination, and he has been fighting for 30 years to get his film back in Los Angeles. Yeah. It's Scott's his first name, Scott Enyart, I think his name is. And so it was actually very instructive to me listening to his case. And, he, you know, he's a very, very good person, you know, very straight down the line. And they said that he had to go and, you know, they were saying that in this court case, they said he had to go and see a psychiatrist, you know, and they tried to character assassinate him. And but he still won the case. So this is the sort of thing they can do. And if Dr. Wood's case does go forward, that will be what they will do. They will bounce it around the courts. They will get all the hotshot attorneys onto it, and you know, they'll try and character assassinate everyone. And you know, they always do it. I mean, it was done, I think it was done in Jim Garrison's case, you know, and all these cases. They always do it because that's the way the system is. It's controlled by these people. That's the way they live. That's the way they think, you know. So you have to prepare. If you want to take it forward, you're going to you know, they don't kill you off, you're going to have to put up with that, you know. I think that says a lot, that somebody, you know, Dr. Wood as a researcher, as a person, is wanting to take this forwards and try and hold these people accountable, because we can prove that they've covered it up. If we have a fair hearing, you know, it can be proved from the evidence that these contractors who worked for NIST, you know, you can go and look on this website and find out who they are, Dr. Wood's website, they committed fraud. They participated in a fraud. And the cost of that fraud, I think, was something like $16 million. But, of course, in much the same way as the case I mentioned about Robert F. Kennedy, the film that this guy took, that essentially proved that the official story of Robert Kennedy's assassination was another whitewash. It was another, you know, made-up job. In the same way, this case is against NIST contractors, you know, for a relatively small sum of money compared to what 9/11 as an event represents. Nevertheless, if that case was proved and heard fairly, it would, of course, show that the entire story of 9/11 and everything that followed was false, and everything was based on falsity. So,
well, what happened to the original Scholars for 9/11 Truth Group? I remember hearing that they were out there, but I haven't heard anything for years.
Yeah, good question. Well, I can't remember if I spoke about this last time I came on, but I'll give you a thumbnail sketch. I was actually invited to join Scholars for 9/11 Truth in late 2005, so that's just about 4 years ago, actually, now, since Steve Jones wrote to me and said, oh, please invite Andrew into the Scholars Group as a full member, even though I'd explained to them that I was only a part-time academic. I wasn't a, you know, I haven't published any research. I've just got a, you know, sort of Bachelor's of Science degree. I've not got any Master's degrees or Advanced degrees or anything like that. And they still invited me as a full member, which was rather strange. But I basically discovered that the Scholars for 9/11 Truth was actually part of the cover-up. Because, to cut a long story short, the Scholars for 9/11 Truth split into two halves at the beginning of 2007. Jim Fetzer took one half, and Steve Jones formed the Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, took the other half. Most of the people went in, seemed to go with Jones's side. I kind of went with Fetzer's side, because at that time Jim Fetzer had started to support Dr. Judy Wood, and he'd had her on his web radio program quite a number of times to discuss her latest findings. And Jim Fetzer was quite supportive of both myself and Dr. Wood right up until Dr. Wood's research uncovered the connection to the Hutchison effect. Then Jim Fetzer ended up calling John Hutchison a fraud, and then he said that Judy Wood's reputation was under threat because she'd associated herself with a fraud, or very likely a fraud. Fetzer started attacking me, saying that I was childish for pointing out various errors in his logic. I tried to point out to Jim Fetzer that we had the evidence that John Hutchison was a legitimate scientist. He had 500 pounds of metal samples. We had documents from Los Alamos National Laboratories. We had John Alexander saying that what John Hutchison did was real. But John Alexander's a very curious character. So basically, the scholars group was split into two halves, and then I left the scholars group when Jim Fetzer started attacking me, it wasn't long after that that Dr. Wood resigned her name from the list. I don't even know who's on the list now, because Jim Fetzer doesn't support the Keytam case. He doesn't talk about the Keytam case. Steve Jones doesn't talk about it. In fact, almost nobody talks about Dr. Wood's Keytam case openly. If you ask them, they probably won't give you a good reason either. That's been my experience as to why they won't talk about it.
And there's still a fair amount of significant talk show hosts that don't even go there with her work.
Correct.
Which is still kind of been real curious to me.
Yes,
you know.
That's right. It is very strange. And so I think, I've as I mentioned it last time I came on, I've written a book about this. It's called 9/11, Finding the Truth. And I say I've written a book. Really, the book is a way of me giving access to those who haven't got internet access to all the articles that I've written. I've written this book runs to 300 pages. And it's really a compilation of articles that I've had to write to document all of this story, which I just summarized in the last 5 minutes, over the last 2.5 years, almost 3 years now, in fact. So anybody that wants to read that book, they can download it for free. If they Google 9/11 book, Andrew Johnson, they'll find it. If they go onto the website, checktheevidence.com, they'll see a banner and they can click on it. If you want to buy a paperback copy, you can, but, you know, it'll cost you about $12, $15, I don't know what it is in dollars. It's about £8, £9, I hear, if you get one copy for yourself.
Your website, again, is checktheevidence.com.
Correct, yes, correct.
To download this book, 9/11 Finding the Truth.
Correct, yes, yeah, that's right. And there's some reviews on there. People have posted reviews, and just about everyone that's read it has, no one has really. In fact, Jim Fetzer wrote to me and he says, I've discovered four serious errors in your book, but he hasn't told me what they are. Still hasn't told me what they are. Again, he sort of attacked me and insulted me, but he hasn't told me what these errors are. I'm still waiting to find out what they are. And he's aware of it because it's posted. He knows that it's been posted. It's all very peculiar. Going into other things like we have this film made by Sophia Schafquat or Sophia Smallstorm, 9/11 Mysteries, which was a very well produced 9/11 film. It talked about molten metal and all this. And I gave away a few copies of this 2 or 3 years ago whenever it came out, and Sophia explains that she spent $35,000 of her own money on this. And I think it was at some point we, either Dr. Wood or myself, we sort of approached her and said, well, would you like to make a film about the directed energy weapons evidence? And she basically said no, to cut a long story short. And then, just about, I think it was I'm trying to remember the date. I think it was about March this year. She came out with this theory that she thought that fluoride was used to destroy the World Trade Center, or fluorine. And she did this on a radio program, saying that because fluorine could dissolve steel, that's what they could have used to destroy the steel in the World Trade Center. And she was serious about this. She didn't have
Where does she figure to get this evidence, though? I mean, I'm sure.
Good question. You know, you have to go and listen to the interview if you want to see, because I listened to the interview and then I listened to the first hour where she was presenting this, and I think she on the second hour she talked about something else. But you know, I went and studied the chemistry of fluoride and fluorine in relation to steel, and what she failed to make a distinction. For example, fluorine is a gas; it's a green gas. And it's just a very toxic gas like chlorine, you know, and it's in its atomic state or molecular state, very poisonous. It doesn't dissolve steel. What does dissolve steel is hydrogen fluoride, which is what you get if you dissolve fluorine gas in water. In other words, you know, you may have heard of hydrochloric acid. That's HCl. So I knew about the chemistry. I mean, I did some of this at school, you know, so. So I sort of went and brushed up my chemistry, and it's just I knew what she was saying was just complete nonsense, you know. So why is this 9/11 researcher who spent $30,000 or $38,000 whatever dollars of her money on a film coming out with this theory that fluoride destroyed the World Trade Center? What is the purpose? Why does that help anybody or anything? And the answer is, it doesn't help anybody. What it's done is deliberately to confuse people. Because what's going on is a muddle-up. We've called it a muddle-up, where you get all this information put out, knowingly false information mixed in with everything else, deliberately to throw people off the scent. You've got thermite, you've got nukes, you've got explosives, you know, all this stuff. It's all mixed into one great big melting pot, and the ordinary person has absolutely no idea how to sort it all out, and that's why it's done that way.
Okay, now, what program was she on, do you know?
Well, if you give me a second, I can find it for you. I can't remember which one it is off the top of my head, but I will find it for you in a moment.
Okay.
It was, let's just see, it was about, let's see where it was. It was about, I think about March or April this year. Let's see.
Was it on her own program?
No, it wasn't on her own program. I think it was, it was Mike somebody. Mike Herzog, I think.
Oh, Herzog. Okay, Michael, yeah. Herzog. Okay.
Herzog, yeah. Yeah, it was. Okay. I think it was on his program.
Okay, then I'm sure he's got an archive on his.
Well, I've got it on my website too. I had to put this on website because it was such a classic. It was. I'll just see if I can find the exact dates. I'm just trying to. Yeah, there we go. It was the 16th of March 2009, and yeah, it was Mike Herzog, The American Awakening. So that I've got hour one of that program on my website. So why is this person who's made 9/11 films, why are they just, you know, she didn't have any scientists backing up this fluoride, you know. I mean, if she'd had like Professor such and such from so and so university saying, oh, you know, I've got on the line with me Professor such and such who studied the evidence from the World Trade Center and he's given me these examples of how fluoride, you know. None of that. There's none of that, you know. She just said that it can dissolve metal. I think she mentioned about three characteristics or something, and that was about it. I listed these. I had to write an article about it, and this went in the book as well. And then she turned up with Alfred Weber on another program, talking about HAARP having destroyed the World Trade Center. And again, Alfred Weber had been a supporter of Dr. Wood, and even Alfred Weber had interviewed, and we've got a recording of the interview, of John Hutchison and Judy Wood at his house, and then he did this 2-hour or 3-hour long interview with this Lorraine Murray, who claims to be a geoscientist who worked at Lawrence Livermore. And in that interview he said, tell me, Lorraine, how you are sure that HAARP was used to destroy the World Trade Center. And she went on and listed all the evidence that's on Dr. Wood's website, and then she just said, oh, that's why Harp did it. And there was absolutely no mention of the Hudson effect at all by Alfred Weber, even though he'd interviewed John Hudson and Dr. Wood in his house a few months prior to this interview with Lorraine Murray. You know, and I've got all the audio recordings on my website. I've written all this up into an article so people can go and read it. So why is there such an obvious cover-up of the Hudson effect in relation to 9/11? What I mean is, you know, it's perfectly fine for somebody like Lorraine Murray to come onto a program with Alfred Weber and say, you know, I think it was Harp that destroyed the World Trade Center. That's absolutely fine. You know, I haven't got any problem with that. But for Alfred Weber, you know, not to say, do you know what, Lorraine? Well, I had Dr. Judy Wood and John Hudson in my house in February this year, and they described all this evidence to me. And I think, you know, we should think about that as well. That could have played a role here. He didn't say that. He didn't mention the Hudson effect once. Now, if that's not strange and weird, then I don't know what is.
You know, so are you saying that the Harp may be involved in creating the Hudson effect?
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay. And Harp, why is that? Why would you say it isn't?
Well, because if somebody wanted to show me that Harp was used in the destruction of the World Trade Center, the evidence that they would have to show is the direct evidence of the effects that Harp can create. Now, Harp is disclosed to be an ionospheric heater. So did we see any ionospheric effects on 9/11? I don't know, because we can't directly see those ionospheric effects. All that we know that Harp...
No, but we did see Hurricane Erin, which looked very much like a Tesla coil.
Well, you know, you're mixing together a number of things, because let's try and separate them out. Harp is its disclosed function is an ionospheric heater. Some people think that Harp can modify the weather, and there's been one instance that I know of that I've heard of mentioned in a Discovery Channel documentary where the jet stream was apparently altered during some type of Harp activity. But if people want to say that Harp was used on 9/11, they need to come up with some evidence in terms of usage logs, where Harp was pointing, the frequencies that it was set to, the power level that it was set to, who was operating it. If Harp is implicated in 9/11, then we need a whistleblower before we can say that it was definitely used. We need some hard evidence, because the effects that Harp is said to have can be anything. That people say it's used for mind control. It may be used for mind control, but I don't know. I haven't seen any evidence that convinces me that it actually is. We don't know that it can actually be used to steer hurricanes. People say that it can be used to steer hurricanes, but nobody has taken, for example, Harp usage data and correlated that with, you know, Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Wilma, any of these other, Hurricane Andrew, any other of these storms that have done damage. Nobody has done that correlation to my knowledge. And if they have, you know, I haven't seen it. If anybody can find it, I'm happy to look at it. But I think that Harp is basically just a cover for something else. Obviously, it's a real system. It has a real purpose. But I think the other technology is somewhere else. And if you look at the patent for Harp, it's a phased antenna array which uses RF radiation. It doesn't use electrostatic radiation as well. It doesn't, nothing similar to what John has done. It doesn't use Tesla coils. You did mention that a hurricane does look like a Tesla coil. Yes, if you look at the side profile, it does. And it involves a charge separation. So yes, that is an interesting coincidence. But I don't see that we can directly implicate Harp in the creation of that hurricane or the steering of it. I haven't seen any evidence that that's what was used.
Then what do you think would have been the instrument used to create the directed energy for the towers?
Or even Building 7, which didn't get hit by anything.
Well, again, Building 7, Dr. Wood has a whole study on Building 7, which you can go and read if you want to, or go and check out. That's on her website too. What appears to have been involved somehow is some type of microwave beam, only part of the weapon. Now, unfortunately, microwaves are associated in people's minds with heating, exclusively, you know, because of microwave ovens. But the way that microwaves heat things up, as you know, is selective. You know, you can put certain materials in a microwave oven and switch it on, and it doesn't heat. Water will heat up, paper will not, for example. And that's because of the frequency that the microwave is tuned to, and the material that's actually in, you know, heating, like water molecules. The frequency of the microwave is tuned to the frequency, the natural resonant frequency of a water molecule. That's why it heats up the water. And so, you know, to try and answer your question, I don't know what the actual full nature of the weapon was. All that we can say is that it was some type of interference effect. In other words, it was several different types of energies, one or more. There may have been 100 different beams involved. I really don't know how many there were, where they projected from. I suspect if you look at John's equipment, you know, he needs 2 tons of equipment, and he uses about 1.5 kilowatts of power to generate the effects, which is about as much as you need to boil a kettle. I suspect that if you have a multi-trillion-dollar black budget, you can miniaturize that technology, and you can probably put it in something the size of a suitcase, and it will need no power to run. It will run off virtually nothing. You could run it off a car battery, because you can certainly get 1.5 kilowatts out of a car battery. So I suspect that the weapon may have been quite small, or one component of it was. I don't know. That's pure speculation on my part, but I think it would have been small enough to conceal it. Or if not, it may have been high up in the sky. I recently heard an interview by somebody who's studying TWA 800, and he came across evidence that there was some type of platform that was at 100,000 feet up that they had for monitoring missile launches or something, because it appears that TWA 800 was shot down by a missile. So who knows? Who knows what's up there? I don't know what's up there. You can go and look at John Leonard Walson's films on YouTube. He's got a film called Far Above Space and Time, or a selection of films. He appears to have filmed these things in orbit using a 10-inch telescope and some special technique that he uses. So what are those things that are up there? You know, they appear to be stationary as he's filming them. What are they?
You know? Well, I guess I was kind of always assuming that it was HARP that they were referring to that might have been involved with this.
I doubt it very much.
Okay.
Because HARP isn't exactly a beaming weapon technology. It's an ionospheric heater. In other words, it uses radio waves to heat up the ionosphere. That's its disclosed purpose. And you know, you can go and read about, you can go and look at Bernard Eastland's patent and see what it does. And it's called a phased array. His paint used something much bigger, apparently. It was going to be many more antennae than they've got the one in Alaska. But also, there are at least 3 of these things. There's one in Norway, and there's one in Russia somewhere. So, you know, was it all 3? You know, but you've got to pin this down if you want to say that's what did it. But nobody has presented any convincing evidence that that HARP was involved in 9/11 at all that I've seen.
I'm glad to hear you at least, I mean, state this, because I just wasn't quite sure where they were figuring this kind of energy would come from, other than if they have something that's set up, you know, on satellite or from other medium to transport that kind of energy or magnify it so that it can do that kind of an effect.
Mm. Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, you know, we don't know what all of HARP's capabilities are. But all I'm saying here is that from what I've read and what I understand about HARP and what I've heard Bernard Eastland describe, and Bernard Eastland is a physicist who invented the technology behind HARP, I don't see it has any relation to the evidence that I've, you know, seen for 9/11. You know, there may be some facility underneath HARP, you know, buried underground, but we just have no evidence of that. So it's just complete speculation, you know, as to what might be there.
Well, maybe that is part of where the question comes in on where Dr. Woods, you know, speculation comes from. I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying.
Well, I think what the temptation is really is that Dr. Wood doesn't speculate, you know, for very long, if at all.
Right.
Because, you know, she looks at the evidence of what's at the World Trade Center and what destroyed it, and then she, you know, you can rule out certain things. You can rule out nuclear bombs. You can rule out thermite and that sort of thing. But you can't, you know, you can't then jump to say exactly where the weapon was or who switched it on, how much energy the weapon used in itself. All you can look at is the anomalous energy effects. And we know that HAARP uses conventional energy to power it as well. It's powered by from the ARCO, the gas field in Alaska. So we know what its power source is. But if you look at the energy that was used to destroy, I mean, this is the other thing. You know, the input power to HAARP, if you do the energy calculations, you can calculate how much energy is used to power HAARP. Nobody's done that calculation to compare that amount of energy with the energy required to destroy the World Trade Center. You know, so those calculations could be done by somebody, but nobody's done them.
Most of the directed energy weapons that I've seen are so, they don't look like they could be, you know, they're not that big, any of the film footage that I've seen or pictures.
Well, this is the whole point, because the directed energy weapons that we see in the white world, such as the Mobile Tactical High Energy Laser, which was developed by Northrop Grumman, you can look at that on their website, and the Airborne Laser, which is developed by Lockheed Martin and Boeing and others, they're all powered by conventional power systems, as far as we know. You know, diesel generators or gas, you know, turbines or whatever it is. This weapon is not powered by conventional energy, as far as we can tell. It's powered by free energy, energy from the vacuum. That's why they have to keep it covered up, because once that's revealed, the whole world's economic system is revealed as a lie. You know, it's as simple as that.
I mean, there's a little bit of an irony in that one.
Well, yeah, you know. But once you have free energy, you don't need to mine oil. You know, this technology can be used to transmute materials. You know, you could convert lead into gold using this technology, because that's another thing that John Hutchison has found.
That's the other. I've been trying to find somebody that I knew was talking about that, because... Okay, so John does speak of that.
Transmutation, yeah. He's in some of his metal samples, you get small regions where I can't remember the exact transmutation that he's observed, but you do get steel turning into iron, which is where the carbon is somehow removed from it. This again, you know, shows that it's a molecular or atomic or a nuclear level process that's happening, where electrons or neutrons are being moved around in the nucleus, or protons are being converted into something else, and the elements are changing. And this is what, again, relates back to cold fusion, because this is one of the other big things with cold fusion that all the scientists went into uproar over. Because when people like Pons and Fleischmann says, well, you know, we've got these elements in our test tube, which weren't there before, we've got these new elements, that's not allowed. You can't have one element changing into another. You can't have, palladium turning into another metal. It's not allowed.
You know, this is the one thing that really I have been asking this question, because the very first thing that strikes me on those who control the gold and that sort of thing is you hear about alchemy, mm-hmm. and it seems like that would be a huge driving force for man to be able to create gold.
Yeah.
And to have it be so quiet and they automatically just say, oh, there's no way, it's no, whatever. That right there is a huge clue to me, is start digging, because there's something there why they are not doing it, because it's not human nature to ignore that sort of a process.
I agree, and I think what you're seeing again is another of the world's control mechanisms being challenged. I mean, in the same way that, you know, we can have free energy, which we can, and we know that now because of what happened on 9/11, we know it for sure without any doubt, that again opens up the possibility of changing one element into another. So the other world's control mechanism, you know, the value of gold, which is a big influence on the financial markets, that can also be controlled. Because if somebody somewhere in an underground base or wherever, you know, wherever it is, has this technology, they can create as much gold as they need. They just use this technology to translate, you know, lead into gold, to transmute, rather, lead into gold.
So, and it would be no different than, you know, controlling the diamond market or any,
correct,
you know, any
correct
other thing. And yep, and it is so basic to the nature of the creatures that run this world,
correct,
that I find it to be a huge elephant in the room.
They're probably doing it. You know, it's not something I've specifically thought of before this conversation much. I've just maybe given it a passing thought that they could have transmutation technology, you know, which would turn lead into gold. But you see, once you've got free energy, even if you need a huge amount of energy for this process to turn whatever material into gold, if you can get it for free, it doesn't matter. You can do it. So you've then got a way of absolute control. And again, it goes back to the old saying. I was reversing the old saying the other day. You know, we know that the people who run the world are absolutely corrupt, so they must be absolutely powerful. If you reverse the expression, you know, that absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Now this has been my I get onto these little missions,
yeah,
and start digging.
Yeah.
And this is has been my mission lately, because I mean this is something that you find back in hundreds of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
They were talking,
yeah,
about such a thing. So, yeah, they're not going to throw that aside.
No.
There's no way. It's not in human nature.
No. And so I think, you know, the running theme is one of fear and control. And I think, you know, one of the other topics that I've got on the website is about consciousness, because ultimately I feel that what this is about is controlling people's consciousness. And there is something going on with that whole scene, because, you know, I've been having this conversation with another person recently about, you know, the agenda for population reduction. And, you know, you hear about this a lot. You know, people like Alex Jones talk about it a lot, and they're going to kill us all with, you know, and again, we started talking about swine flu a little bit, and that's going to be part of the population reduction and blah de blah. So I once asked myself a question a few years ago. Well, if we've now got this population, you know, reduction agenda, and it's real, then was there a time in the past a population increase agenda, if you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Was there an agenda in the past to increase the human population? And if so, why were we allowed to proliferate? There must be a reason for us being allowed to proliferate, because if these people are absolutely powerful, at least in the physical realm, then why were we allowed to proliferate? So I don't quite know the answer to that question, or whether indeed there was an agenda to allow us to proliferate, but I suspect that there was. So there must be some other thing going on here with human consciousness and what, you know, the collective human consciousness creates as some kind of dimensional entity. There must be somebody that's trying to manipulate and control that as well. Because if we look at how religions have been created over the millennia, and I mean, somebody mentioned this statistic to me a while ago. It's probably true, but I haven't checked it. And they said there are 38,000 different branches of Christianity. You know, I mean, it's, you know, it's just amazing, really, to sort of consider. And I do feel that, you know, tying into some of the things that what we've been talking about in terms of the numbers that are involved, and that the numbers of people that are actually, you know, finding out what happened at the World Trade Center and talking about it.
Are you there?
Yeah, I just heard a phone ringing. So, all right. And the number of people that are actually talking about that is very small, but I think those people who are interested and are, you know, delving deeper, looking at the information with an open mind and an open heart, there is something fundamentally different about those people to the most of the rest of the planet. They've obviously made some kind of decision to follow a path which leads them to a really to a, I think to a new type of consciousness or a new level of consciousness. And it seems to me that when you get onto this sort of path, things start happening to you. And I know that other people have said this, things like the 11-11 phenomena and this sort of thing. Things do seem to start happening to you. I mean, I'll give you an example of what happened to me just about a couple of months ago. I have a friend who lives about 90 miles from here, and we'd arranged to meet about halfway between in a town called Buxton, which is about 40 miles from here, 45 miles. And I met up with him. It was a Friday afternoon, and it was actually on the anniversary of September the 11th this year, so it was a Friday. And but I met up with him. I hadn't seen him for a couple of years. He'd been abroad for a couple of years or a year or so. And we were walking around chatting. It was quite a nice day as well, quite warm, pleasant. And we went and decided to get some lunch. So we went to a pizza restaurant in the town. And we went into this pizza restaurant. And I'd taken my friend a copy of the book, the 9/11 Finding the Truth book, because he said he'd like to have a copy, so I took one with me. And we sat down in the restaurant and we started to chat. And I started talking about something, I think about the hurricane or something, and I wanted to show him some pictures. So I got the book out and I started talking about it. And then the waitress came over to take our order. And she, pretty young girl. She was about 20 years old. And my friend, who was a bit more sort of chatty than I was, I tend not to lay this thing on people in public. It can tend to be a bit much for people. But he started talking about this, and he said, "Oh, do you know?" He said to the waitress, "Do you know what day it is today?" And she said, "Well, yeah." And she said, and he said, "You know, it's the anniversary of the attacks on September the 11th." And she said, "Yes." And he said, "My friend's written a book about this, and he pointed to me, and I'm thinking, "Oh no, don't bring this up, in the middle of a restaurant." But he did. And so I looked at her and I said to her, "Well, did you hear about the hurricane on that day?" And she said, "No." So I started showing her the pictures, and I started showing her some of the other pictures in the book, and I explained a bit about, the destruction of the World Trade Center. And I was watching her closely. And I was thinking, is she going to glaze over here and, tell me to go away or not talk about it? But she seemed quite interested. And I said, do you understand what I'm saying? Is this interesting to you? And she said, "Well, yes, it is, because I'm actually a civil engineering student." And this young girl, turns out, was one of four girls in 95 students. She was in the third year of her university course. And she was due to go back to university the next day for the start of the new semester. And we'd started to speak to her about 9/11 and, Dr. Judy Wood's research and this sort of thing. In the middle of this restaurant, she was actually filling in for somebody who was off sick. She wasn't down to work that day. So what are the chances of me travelling 45 miles to a pizza restaurant to meet my friend on 9/11 and ended up talking to a female civil engineering student in a restaurant, I mean,
but your chances are going to be better now than maybe 7 or 8 years ago, or maybe.
Possibly so. But I mean, that was just a very bizarre situation. I've had a few things like that happen to me, and it does seem that there is this sort of higher process going on, which you sort of get hooked into, or you hook into it. I'm not sure which way round it works, but I've had things like that happen to me several times. In fact, just the other day, in fact, it was yesterday, I was thinking, I sell discs from my website, and there was this chap who's bought a few things off the website several times over the last few years, and I was thinking, "Oh, I wonder if he'll ever come back and order any more discs." And yesterday, this chap, he logged on and he ordered some discs. It was just bizarre. I think it was the day before I was thinking about it. So, again, this is to do with this consciousness that we seem to be sort of latching into somehow.
I know what you're talking about, because I experience it a lot, actually. Mm. And But I've noticed, I mean, it just started. Mm. It may have been here a lot, but I think a lot of us are now being more cognizant of, you know, it going on, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's obviously an element of that. I mean, once you start opening up to the bigger picture, you're going to be more attuned to paying attention to those things. Certainly, I think there's a level of that. But you know, what I've experienced probably goes some way beyond that. And it's not mm-hmm. been, it doesn't happen every day, but it's just little things like that that have happened. And again, you know, maybe talking about the swine flu thing a little bit, because
right, yeah, I did want to hit that.
Yeah, you know, when that story started to break, we got suspicious. There was a chap that I know he lives not far from here, and he really set my antennae going on that story, because it was in I think it was March this year, middle of March. Our local paper, our local paper published this story about a possible pandemic coming, and the hospital was stocking up on, you know, surgical masks and this sort of thing. And it said that this pandemic could kill 1 in 80 people. And this was in March. And it was 3 weeks later when the swine flu story in Mexico was first reported. You know, so we wrote to the paper. I think he wrote to the paper and emailed them and said, well, why are you putting out this story? Or what made you put out this story, you know, just before this Mexico pandemic was first reported? And they just said, oh, well, you know, we're going on information from the Department of Health, which is, you know, the sort of main department in the UK, which looks after the NHS, the National Health Service here. What I found out after that, I think I found this posted on a forum, so I went and checked out the story. 19th of March 2009, Medical News Today reported that a French pharmaceutical company, Sanofi Aventis, invests 100 million euros in a new facility in Mexico to produce seasonal and pandemic influenza vaccine. So, I thought, that's a good investment then, isn't it?
When was this? This was this year?
This was March 19th. Yeah, that was in Medical News Today. So that was 1 month mm-hmm. before the first reported outbreak. So there you go. Somebody knew that this was coming.
What about the thing with Baxter?
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Jane Burgermeister story. Yeah, she found out that Baxter released, 72 kilos of this avian flu vaccine, live vaccine, to... 27 or 18 countries or something, I can't remember the number. And then there was this incident, I think, in Switzerland or Sweden on this train, an IC train. They had a case of exploding swine flu vials meant for a research lab on a busy intercity train in Switzerland. You know, and she essentially filed criminal charges because the way they dealt with this incident, or, you know, they didn't treat anybody, they didn't try and quarantine anybody, or they didn't sort of do a clean-up of any appropriate kind.
Do you blow up virus like that?
Good question. How did it explode on a train? Yeah, I've no idea. But these were the charges that Jane Burgermeister filed. And then what happened in the UK, something which I don't recall happening in the UK before, is we all got a leaflet through the door. And it said, important information about swine flu. And this came through, I think, in about sort of April or May time. And this actually contains false information. And I was able to get this admitted by the Department of Health. In this leaflet, which went to all UK households, I mean, that would have cost, you know, probably at least £1 million to distribute this leaflet to all the UK households. In the leaflet, it said, no one will have immunity to the swine flu virus. That's what it actually said in this leaflet. Now, I knew that was false, because there's always a level of natural immunity to any virus, you know, even if it's quite a low level. There are always people that are immune to these things. You know, and also I later challenged my local health authority on this, and I said, well, look, you know, your level of immunity depends on your fitness, it depends on your diet, it depends on lots of things. So, you know, some people become sick from a virus more easily than others. You know, and they tried to say that this wasn't true. But the number of medical studies which show that, you know, vitamin supplements can boost your immunity. So just looking through some of the notes I've got here on this, because I did a talk on this in London last month. And what I decided to do was I decided to write a list of about 17 questions to my local health authority, which has responsibility for about a million people in the county where I live. And I set them a list of 17 questions, and I asked them if they were aware that Jane Burgermeister had filed these criminal charges against Baxter, who are one of the suppliers of the vaccine. The health authority wasn't aware of that. And I said to them, can you state clearly why swine flu is perceived as being so threatening when so far no symptoms other than those of normal flu seem to have been reported? And their response to that was that the UK has been preparing for a possible flu pandemic for the last 3 to 4 years. This has been on the basis that historical patterns of infection suggested that a pandemic would emerge in this generation. These preparations were predicated on a potential threat posed by the avian flu influenza H5N1 virus. Now,
can I point one thing out? The global warming thing and the timing mm-hmm. of these things mm-hmm. seem to come in the same package. I just maybe by chance, I don't mm-hmm. know. But back when the swine flu was going around, it was somewhere in that vicinity that they were also saying we were going into an ice age. So now that we've got this swine flu, H1N1, you know, bird flu, whatever. We get these things coming again, like stress factors or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's true. That does seem to be what's happening, because we've had the global warming hoax thing, you know, coming out now, and we've had this the Fort Hood shooting. We've had the trial of the suspect in New York. You know, the terrorist suspect. We've had, the ongoing banking sort of scares and everything. We've had Obama's announcing the swine flu as a national emergency. The point I was going to make about what I just said, though, that the health authority were telling me that they were basing this projection of a pandemic on this idea that because of the avian flu, but the avian flu never became a threat to anyone in this country. So the health authority couldn't provide me with any evidence. There were no medical studies. There was nothing. They couldn't provide any evidence that a pandemic was due. All they said, it was a possible pandemic. And yet, you know, again, I wrote to the Department of Health, which is responsible for the whole country, and they said, let's see. Swine flu poses a threat because it is a new type of flu virus that few, if any, people have full resistance to. In most cases, the virus has proved relatively mild, as you suggest. However, around the world, thousands of people have died, and it is not clear how big a risk the virus is. For this reason, and because all viruses can mutate to become more potent, scientists are advising a cautious approach. But they didn't provide any references, they didn't name any scientists, they didn't link me to any studies, they provided no evidence of a coming pandemic. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I asked the Department of Health, which is responsible for the, you know, giving policies to the National Health Service in the UK, I said, which companies are producing the vaccine? And they replied that it was Baxter Healthcare Limited and GlaxoSmithKline. So I got it in writing from them that those are indeed the two companies that are producing the vaccine. They didn't seem concerned about these criminal charges that have been filed against Baxter. They didn't express any concern about that. And I asked them, are the drug companies in the UK immune from prosecution by those people that experience any serious or debilitating side effects after having the vaccine, as happened in 1976? They replied, the government signed the advanced purchase agreements for the vaccines in June 2007 and accepted liability for their safety as a contingency. All governments signing up to an advance purchase agreement were expected to provide an indemnity for the vaccine, and neither manufacturer would sign the contracts without it. So this was just astounding. In other words, they'd actually agreed to get vaccines 2 years ago, and not only that, the government had effectively underwritten the pharmaceutical companies for any damage.
Well, isn't there a patent that was applied for by Baxter? I think it was Baxter on that several years ago.
On the vaccine or the virus?
I thought it was the virus, but I could be.
Yeah, I can't remember now. I was reading. It was either a patent on something to do with the virus or some virus research. Yeah, there's some very very funny stuff going on. The other thing that somebody had posted as well, which was interesting, is that we've got this World Health Organization advisory checklist for influenza pandemic preparedness planning. And you can go onto the WHO website and download this. And it says, in this document, during a pandemic, it may be necessary to overrule existing legislation or individual human rights. Examples are the enforcement of quarantine, and that's the enforcement of quarantine, overruling individual freedom of movement, use of privately owned buildings for hospitals, off-license use of drugs, compulsory vaccination or implementation of emergency shifts in essential services. These decisions need a legal framework to ensure transparent assessment and justification of the measures that are being considered and to ensure coherence with international legislation, brackets, international health regulations. Now, I wrote to our health Department of Health in the UK and said, is Britain a signatory to this checklist? Or is EU, UK or other legislation in place which would mean that this checklist can be applied to UK citizens? And they replied, the WHO document to which you refer is simply intended as guidance to assist member states in their flu pandemic planning. But, you know, so I was glad that I got that in writing, because this WHO document talks about compulsory vaccination, which is one of the only documents where I've actually seen that mentioned, even though I've heard a lot of talk about it, and various states in the US, I believe, have tried to, you know, do things which are like compulsory vaccination by excluding you from school if you don't have
Well, basically, President Bush actually had executive orders that addressed this.
Hmm.
You know, that they could actually give you vaccines that hadn't been tested?
Yeah, yes, yeah.
It sounds like the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. So, again, we're seeing this global policy being implemented. So, you know, people say, oh, the New World Order and global government's coming. Well, you know, we've got global chemtrails, we've got global weather control, we've got a global policy on swine flu and pandemic, you know, and global warming. So, if we haven't got a global government now, what would you call it? You know,
right.
I mean, I didn't vote for chemtrails. You know, I don't know about you.
So where is stress in the on the list of where would stress be if it was 1 to 10 as a precursor or be accredited for a killing off of the people?
I don't know. I think that's a good question, but I think, you know, again, there's been various studies. I'm not a doctor, but, you know, I think it's quite clear that if you get into a stressful situation and you get into a state of fear, then that does have an impact on your health. I mean, you know, all these biofeedback studies that have been done, you know, so once you put people into a state of fear, you know, their health is gonna deteriorate. I don't think there's any question of that, you know, at all.
Well, I was just watching a series that, you know, it was called America with a K or something, and it goes back, it was done back in the 80s or whatever, and ultimately it shows that, you know, the changing of our governments and sovereignty and all these things, you know, can be accomplished much easier than one thinks. But when you add the fact of knowing that whenever there is a huge takeover of other peoples, there's usually a large extermination of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, to me, seems to be an overriding factor. Is what we need to be looking at here is this part of this, you know, I mean, we know, those of us that have been studying it understand that there really is a you know, they put out the word, you talk to so many people that their population, the planet is overpopulated. They have no basis to back that up generally, but they will, that'll be the first thing out of people's mouths.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, we're seeing so many things that contribute to it because medicine no longer heals. It's just the disease control.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. I mean, institutionalized medicine is done more for the interests of selling a product and the pharmaceutical companies than it is to actually heal the individual. And over the years, you know, you can see how the system has evolved such that, you know, you go to the doctor with an illness, a regular doctor, and he'll just sort of make a few notes, then he'll type something into the computer, come up with the latest pill, and you know, and then prescribe that, and then that's it, you're cured. You're obviously not cured, but that's the sort of paradigm that the doctor operates in these days in the allopathic medicine. So you know, I think you know what that ties into as well is how we've got into the state that we're in, because we've been encouraged to you know, discharge our responsibilities and let someone else do the thinking for us. So rather than trying to treat ourselves for whatever it is, whatever ailments we may have, we discharge that responsibility to somebody else, and we go to an expert to actually give us the right answer, as it were, for us, rather than sort of taking the time to inform ourselves and treat ourselves. And that is a common theme, I think, through health, through, you know, diet, through entertainment, through going to school, you know, through university. You know, you tend to just want to be fed the answers at the university, rather than you're not taught to think for yourself particularly. So, you know, we've discharged our responsibilities to experts, you know, of various kinds, and that opens us up to even, you know, greater and wider manipulation and control.
Right. And I think this kind of, you know, even with the subjects that I cover on my program and looking at what you have on your website, I mean, even though they seem to be somewhat eclectic in coverage of various subjects, but they all still come back to the fact that they can all still tie into an agenda by those that have decided that they, you know, want to control this world. And what do you think?
I agree totally. And I've discussed with several people, you know, recently, and the simple phrase is, we're somebody's cattle. That's, you know, the field is a technological field, you know, full of distractions, but we're somebody's cattle. You know, we do have a higher purpose. And this higher purpose is sort of talked of in most religions, but it's never really clearly defined. And what they do define in religion is all these hoops that you've got to jump through to, you know, get to your higher purpose, when really these hoops are just another form of, you know, control, really. So I think you can achieve your higher purpose by, you know, focusing on finding out what the answer to a given question is, and looking for the truth.
And it's like you said, you ask one question, you start looking to find out that there's questions everywhere.
That's right. And I think, you know, because the agenda is being advanced, and, you know, like you were saying a few minutes ago, we're getting the swine flu and the global warming thing together, whereas maybe before we'd get one year and one the next. we're now getting them all in the same year. And again, you know, going back to the alien thing, they're really trying to ramp that up now and bring it mainstream to cancel out all the ridicule giggle factor that's been built up over the last few years. And this, they've been doing this now for a couple of years, and you can watch them doing it. You can actually see this unfolding if you know what the ultimate goal is. And this therefore all ties in with this idea that they're going for total control now. Total control. They want to control your health, the air that you breathe, which comes into, you know, the carbon taxation and all that. They want to control your thoughts, you know, TV. They're controlling a lot of the internet, not all of it, but a lot of it. You know, they want to control the money supply so that, you know, it doesn't matter how hard you work, you know, you will never be in control of your finances because, you know, all your finances have crashed in the credit crunch. You know, they want to control the property that you live in. They want to know your whereabouts. They're going to track your movements. But, you know, my attitude to that is, so what? You know, you can track my movements. I don't care. You know, I'm not, if you want to know where I'm going, I'm not bothered. You know, I've got nothing to hide. So I don't care about that. I do know that other people care, and they should. They do have a right, a very basic human right, not to be tracked. The problem is that we have to reject the system, and I almost think that we can't just reject part of it. We end up rejecting all of it, or maybe reject is the wrong word, but we have to work out a way of moving outside of it and living our lives without being reliant on the system. But this is obviously very, very tricky, you know.
You know, the one interesting part about all this that I perceive is when you try to control someone else, that you have just set up the parameters for your own control. It's kind of like when you try to wall somebody else in, that means that you have now been either walled in or walled out. So they don't, when you try to categorize and data bank and do everything that they're doing at this point in time, means that they've also set up their Achilles heel.
I agree with you because, you know, if you look at some of the people who, like, these responses I got from the Department of Health, you know, you do sometimes think that you're being responded to by robots, you know, and at what point are these people going to come to the point of, you know, why am I doing this job? You know, why am I helping to keep this covered up? You know, I mean, hopefully these organic robots are going to sort of wake up and realize that they themselves are serving an agenda, you know, without necessarily realizing it.
Right, right.
So, you know, that's my hope.
I appreciate you coming on, Andrew, and discussing your research and thoughts. And,
well, thank you very much.
And I hope that we can do this again. And
sure.
Any closing comments, or Katie, either one?
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you for showing us some new alternatives that may have not been out there for us before. And I hope maybe you'll come back and talk about what's going on with the next phase.
Sure, any time. There's things still going on. You know, people can go to the website. Everything's free to download. I've collected a lot of information over the last few years, you know, so if you've got an iPod and you want to find some interesting audio, you'll find it on there. Please download it and, you know, try and just make your own sense out of it. But the main thing is not to live in fear, despite all the horrible, terrible things that are going on and all they're trying to do to us. You know, my dad once said to me years and years ago, never sink to their level, never sink to their level. I've never forgotten that. And that's what we should... We have to rise above it all. That's the challenge that we face, is to rise above all of this, you know, maintain our dignity and our humanity in the face of all these terrible things that they're trying to do to people.
Well, if we sink to their level, we've gone down to the lowest common denominator. Yeah.
Exactly.
And all this information is available out at your website, which is checktheevidence.com.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, again, thank you and good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.